JS on Politics. I'm your host, Greg Borowski, and let's give you a quick rundown here of what's ahead on today's show. So Sheriff David Clark didn't get a cabinet post, but may still get a spot in Donald Trump's administration. What's ahead for him? In Madison, Republicans are taking different directions on roads. Can they reach an agreement? The recount grinds on. Has anything of substance changed? We'll also talk about a Journal Sentinel investigation into Milwaukee landlords who game the system to avoid paying fines and taxes. As always, we'll give you our winners and losers from the past week, and we'll tackle viewer questions. So at first, let's start with our panel here. We have Mary Spicuzza in the studio. Patrick Marley is joining us from Madison. And Patrick and Mary, let's talk about David Clark. So he was up for Homeland Security. He interviewed with Donald Trump. He didn't get that yesterday. What's the takeaways from this on for David Clark moving forward?
He was passed over for a cabinet post. Arguably, there were questions about his qualifications to jump from running a county sheriff's office to a massive agency that's, 400 times the size. So I don't know that people were necessarily shocked that he didn't get it, but he obviously was a huge Donald Trump booster and continues to be. So he could still get another job. I know there's been talk of maybe him running U.S. Marshals or doing something with maybe an advisor post. It probably will not be one of these top-level cabinet positions, but, it remains to be seen what he gets.
Ryan Priebus, who's Trump's new chief of staff, noted that they want to find a spot for David Clark in the administration, and David Clark has sort of basically said, if he's called upon, he will serve, right?
Right. So it sounds like he's going to get something. It won't be Department of Homeland Security, but, it could be, obviously, it could be a very well-paid leg up for him. I guess it'll be a question of, does he have to go to D.C.? He doesn't seem to be a huge fan of the Capitol. So, maybe there's some way he could stay in Milwaukee. We'll have to see what he gets offered and what he wants to take.
All right. So that'll take effect over the next few weeks as they round out the cabinet. And we'll have a little more discussion later on some things in the cabinet. But I did want to mention one other person, though, because we did see Sue Black, who's a former Milwaukee County Parks Director, now Director of Parks in Arizona, who's being discussed for some positions in the Department of Interior and other places.
Yeah, we might have a pretty strong Milwaukee contingent on the Trump administration. We'll have to see what she gets, what Clark gets. I think we will know, certainly in the next week or so. I don't think it's going to go too late into the year. But I guess I wouldn't be surprised if both of them land spots in the administration.
Right, yeah. Do you think, Patrick, let me ask you this one. Because you've got, Ryan Priebus is obviously very close to Donald Trump. Does that give a leg up for folks like Sue Black, David Clark, others with Wisconsin ties, do you think, in terms of getting, critical and important positions in the administration?
I think it helps some. Reince Priebus has been chairman of the Republican Party for a long time, so he's got lots of connections with lots of people all over the country. I think Reince Priebus' role is going to be more helpful in terms of his relationship with the House while Ryan is Speaker, because those two are very close personally. I'm not sure how close Ryan Priebus and David Clark are, but it certainly does not hurt people from Wisconsin's opportunities to have roles in the administration with Ryan Priebus having the high-level position he does.
All right, well, let's shift gears a little bit here and turn to roads. And Patrick, so this week there's been a lot of news again on highway funding, highway constructions, the condition of our state roads, and we've seen a split now again from the Republicans where they're Scott Walker and the Assembly Republicans aren't on the same page. Can you give us a sense of where this issue stands right now?
Sure. The Assembly Republicans are really driving this debate right now. They Robin Voss and others in the Assembly sort of put down this marker that we need more money for roads and did it early, well before the election, saying we need to have this debate over this. Walker came back and said he's not raising taxes unless there's a cut elsewhere in other parts of state government. And so now the Assembly Transportation Committee held a hearing yesterday. This is unusual to be holding hearings between the election and the seating of the new legislature in January to sort of lay on the line all the challenges the state's road fund has. And Mark Gottlieb, who's Walker's transportation secretary, came in and said, if we stay on the path that the governor has proposed, the number of poor roads in the state would double over the next 10 years. We'd see a much higher proportion of our of gas tax going toward registration fees and gas tax going toward debt on past projects rather than being used for new projects.
Yeah, so Mary, you spent time many years covering Madison as well. And how unusual is this dynamic there? Because if you've got the transportation secretary making statements about the roads are going to be in worse condition later, which would seem to help the Assembly Republicans make their case, when Scott Walker's saying, no, we don't want to have, a fee increase or that sort of thing, rather than, cuts elsewhere.
Yeah, it's interesting. Obviously, when Governor Walker first took office in 2011 and got control of the Assembly and Senate, they were really in lockstep. We saw the two Fitzgerald brothers, Big Fitz and Little Fitz, running the show. And I think increasingly we've seen more divisions. Certainly Voss has been very outspoken about road funding for a while now. And I think, they're all in power and now they have to start fighting amongst themselves instead of fighting with Democrats about the way to move forward. But it is interesting to hear somebody who's basically, appointed by Governor Walker saying things that raise serious questions about his policy and his plans for roads. So.
Yeah, and Patrick, I know you have been following this issue, and earlier this week the Assembly Republicans, through Robin Voss, put out a video, right, showing sort of the dangers on the road. Is that, for the public standpoint, I mean, what's the best way to sell something like this to the public? Is the safety and danger, is that a good message in that regard?
Well, clearly the Assembly Republicans think so, that they need to explain to voters how bad the roads are. And so Robin Voss got with his cousin, who's works in that field, got in the back of an ambulance and rode around. And so you saw this video with very shaky footage about all the equipment rattling around. And so I think they're trying to use things like that to make their point. Now, at the same time, the conservatives in the state Senate, they put out their own memo saying, well, if we just say the sky's the limit on spending, we're going to nearly double the gas tax. Robin Voss says he doesn't want an increase anywhere near that size. But everybody's trying to make their positions early so that they can either get the gas tax raised or prevent that from happening.
Yeah. So, Mary, what's your assessment in terms of, what's one of the things that's intriguing to me is that Walker's saying, look, just cut taxes elsewhere. He's not saying he's opposed to an increase. And the Republicans in Madison have not been, shy about trying to cut taxes and cut spending. So why isn't that the pathway? Why isn't that what everyone would just come to?
Cut taxes further?
Yeah.
I think as much as they like cutting taxes, I think that obviously we're seeing a huge surplus in some place like Minnesota, and Wisconsin has nothing near a huge surplus. In fact, we are looking at some, real budget strains. So I think that they're kind of, if you cut taxes and cut taxes, what is that going to do to the budget, which obviously is supposed to balance?
Yeah, and Patrick, so how, I know this has come up before, how have they resolved this in the past, and what in your mind do you see as a pathway that they might, I guess a roadway rather than a pathway, that they might use to get some resolution?
Yeah, so Scott Fitzgerald, the Senate Majority Leader, he's sort of been quiet on this and been sitting back and watching all this, but he said that may be the very path that they take, is, cut some income taxes, cut some other general fund areas, and then find more money for roads that way. I think the challenge is, although that may be the governor's position, there are people like Dewey Strobel and Chris Kapinga who are going to be, they're going to want to cut the taxes, but they're not going to want to see a raise of the gas tax. They want to stand pat. One interesting thing here is this has been an issue that's been foreseeable for a decade. Mark Gottlieb used to be in the state legislature. He headed a panel called the Road to the Future Committee that kind of looked at all these issues. As secretary for 6 years now, he's been saying every couple of years, hey, if we want to build the types of roads that many of us think need to be done, we don't have the money for that. So it's, you work on these in 2-year increments, and in the past we've been able to paper over them. Republican Walker borrowed a lot of money, almost $1 billion in one cycle. I think it was 750-some this most recent budget, and that's helped them sort of get through each budget.
All right, let's turn now to the recount, which was front page news for a while, that Jill Stein was trying to get the results overturned or refined here in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania. It's fizzled quite a bit. But Patrick, what have we seen now that we're, I guess, halfway or more through with all the counting? Any big changes?
Well, no. We're about 70% done, and I think that there's been a net gain of about 82 votes or so for Hillary Clinton. So in recounts, it turns out usually both major candidates gain some votes because some absentee votes that might not have gotten counted initially get picked up. So both Trump and Clinton have made gains. But when you're talking in the neighborhood of 80 votes, that's pretty meaningless with a gap of 22,000 some. So that's the, you know, it looks at this point that there will be no change in the result. We've also learned that it's a lot easier to get a recount in Wisconsin than other states.
Let me just ask one question here for Mary before we'll go to our different segment. But so you've been out to see some of this, or you've covered recounts before? I mean, what do you think causes people to think that this recount's going to make such a big difference, or any recount? Because, I mean, these things are counted. The machines clearly are effective. There's changes, but nothing of this magnitude. Why do people think that is? I mean, that we just count it by hand, that's going to solve everything.
You know, I think that there's been concerns about how accurate are the electronic counting machines, how accurate are, you know, how much is there possibly mechanical error. We've had our president-elect saying that before the election he was saying he was worried it was rigged. Afterwards, he's been saying people were voting illegally. So I think on both sides of the aisle, there's this kind of shared skepticism of how accurate our elections. It might turn out from the Wisconsin recount that we see pretty accurate. But, you know, there are people who are unhappy that, for example, Milwaukee is not hand counting and wanted to see a complete hand count done, or people who are unhappy with the way Waukesha County has been doing it. And there was a dust up on Sunday about how many observers from each party could be there. And so I think that there's just kind of this, maybe on both sides of the aisle, something they can agree on is skepticism about how accurate the elections are. So. Pretty accurate so far. And
it,
you know,
can be done. Who said it couldn't be done?
The thing is, if it turns out that it changes by like 100 votes or 150 votes, obviously you want everybody's vote to be counted accurately. When you're spending millions of dollars to have it show up that it was pretty right on, I don't know that people are gonna feel like this was a useful exercise, but, you know, remains to be seen.
All right. Well, we're going to go now to a tape segment that looks at a story we had in the Journal Sentinel this week, and I've been pursuing this year on landlords in the city of Milwaukee. We're joined now by Carrie Spivak and Kevin Crow, two of our reporters who this year have been writing about landlords in the city of Milwaukee and some of the games and shenanigans they play to avoid paying taxes and fines. Carrie, why don't you tell us a little bit about this latest installment you guys had out this week?
The latest chapter in landlord games was dealing with how lots of landlords create these companies called limited liability companies, and they basically protects the landlord's assets from any creditors, and also allows them to keep their identity secret. Some landlords have been using this to avoid paying pretty heavy-duty fines from the city, and also have been using it to keep their identity secret and to not pay property taxes.
Right. In some cases, they create dozens upon dozens of these. It's not one LLC, it's 10 or 12 or 20 or more.
One in specific that we dealt with was Elijah Muhammad Rashid, who has at least 50 LLCs, and in the name of transparency, his word, he's creating at least 20 more.
Okay. So, Kevin, let me ask you about how, you know, what is the city's explanation as to why they can't more aggressively go after folks who owe fines through these LLCs that technically own the property?
Well, as Carrie said, I mean, one of the functions of LLCs can be to shield the identity of an owner. So somebody can have an ownership interest in an LLC, and you may not necessarily know that from any of the paperwork filed with the state, depending on how they established it. So the city says, well, it's really hard for us to go after these LLCs and find the owners, and even if we did, there may not be any more assets there than the property that we're talking about. So it would take them a lot of time. It's not just going and knocking on the door of a person. You know, I mean, if you're delinquent on your taxes, they know where to find you. If I'm delinquent on my property taxes, they know where to find me, but they may not know where to find First Property Development LLC, and they would have to file a court action and get somebody, you know, get Elijah Muhammad Rashid in the deposition to do that.
Because you guys went out and found these folks, mm-hmm. right? I mean, how were you able to establish some of these connections, Kerry?
Well, pretty much following up from Kevin, it's in one case on Rashid, who has First Property Development, he actually sued Legal Action of Wisconsin, and they deposed him. And in a deposition, you're under oath, and you simply ask, What LLCs do you own? And he has to disclose those. Others, like the person we wrote up on Monday, Jim Herrick, who's a top executive at Robert W. Baird and lives in River Hills, he has his name actually on lots of the papers filed with the state. There's a box where you check for member or manager. He checks it. Others keep their identity secret by having attorneys fill out the form. But also, Herrick and many others, he used his home address for water bills, for property tax bills, so on and so forth. So it's a pretty good clue to the city.
And what's striking to me is those are actually city records with their water bills and where their bills and things are going.
Mm-hmm.
So talk a little bit, Kevin, about what's the reaction been to this series from both readers and then public officials. Let's start with readers. What have you been hearing from folks?
Well, I mean, readers are upset. I mean, they're happy that we're writing about this, obviously, but I mean, they're upset about the situation in general. I mean, they've known. I mean, slumlords and landlords have been around for a while, but the notion that they have been kind of keeping so much money away from the city, almost defrauding the city, is particularly upsetting to a lot of people. And I think one of the biggest things that has happened is that the city filed $1.25 million civil suit against one of kind of the most egregious landlords, which is Mohammed Chaudhry. So that's been one of the biggest
deals. We've seen others, Kerry, I think, that have been paying their fines, including, you know, Devin Harris earlier in this year paid down a lot of his debts.
Yeah.
You know, Mr. Herrick also paid down a proportion prior to the story.
A couple of days after we visited Herrick's home in River Hills and dropped off a letter saying, we'd like to talk to you, we're going to be writing about this. Lo and behold, his LLC's paid over $100,000 in back property taxes. And same thing with Devin Harris, formerly of UW, now with the Mavericks. He was paying some down, but when we wrote it up, yes, he started paying down his fines by an even greater extent.
Right, yeah. So what's the next step here? Is the solution just for the city to be tougher? Are there legal changes, you know, to the state law? What's needed or what's going to happen going forward?
Probably both. The city could be more aggressive, and as Kevin pointed out, they did do the $1.25 million racketeering suit against Chaudhry. They did file some garnishment actions against Elijah Muhammad Rashid during the summer. He's agreed to pay a lot of his fines. He owes about $75,000. And there's probably going to be some legislation coming in that may be dealing with the LLCs, but will definitely be dealing with trying to make the sheriff sales, which is where a lot of these properties are purchased, make that more open and take some steps to try to keep some of the bad apples out of the process.
All right. Well, that's where we'll end our discussion on this. You can find Kerry and Kevin's stories at jsonline.com/landlordgames. And we have more in the pipeline, I know. So thanks for joining us, guys, and check out their stories. All right. So, Mary, you cover City Hall for us, and this is that story we just heard about is a very city-oriented one. What have you been hearing from aldermen and the mayor and others about what can and should they do to help crack down on this situation?
It sounds like after the first of the year, so once, you know, January 2017, we can expect some hearings, and I think that alders and city leaders are going to try to crack down more on landlords who have been gaming the system for some time. So
yeah.
I'd say stay tuned, and probably about a month we'll have some more news.
Right, yeah. Do you think, has their position been, well, we don't have the right tools and we need help from Madison to do it, or simply we can do it and we just need to have the will to jump in and do these things?
I would say probably there's a variety of opinions and maybe somewhere in between, but I do think that there are city officials and the mayor who feel like Madison kind of pulls the rug out from under them, and they had a battle over their zombie homes bill and how foreclosures could be handled, and feeling like they've kind of accused Madison officials of giving a leg up to slumlords and passing different bills that they've benefited from. But I think that there is stuff that the city can do, too, that they don't have to get the nod from Madison before they can take some action.
All right. We're going to go now to our winners and losers segment. And, Mary, you have it first, but I want to hear about your winner.
Okay. So I would say Saturday Night Live. Donald Trump cannot obviously stop watching it or stop tweeting about it. It seems like we are talking about SNL far more than we have in like the last 8 years. So it seems to be doing well, and I can only imagine this is helping their ratings and encouraging Alec Baldwin to come back as Trump.
You would think. And the way every time he tweets about it, it causes people to probably go watch the segment.
Exactly.
To see what is the tweet about.
I know. So. I wonder how many people are actually watching it live when it's on, and then how many are going back and watching the YouTube clips. And there must be like some spike in viewers when...
It's like Saturday night delayed if you're a winner. All right. So, Patrick, let's go to you for your winner from the past week.
Yeah, I'd say it's the Assembly Republicans and the and Robin Voss, their leader. They have a tough road in trying to find more money for roads, but with this transportation hearing this week, they scored points. They got the governor's transportation secretary to acknowledge some severe problems with the condition of the roads under Walker's plan. So they won the battle for the day.
All right, and your loser from the past week, Patrick.
I'm going to say the loser is Jill Stein. Her recount, as we talked about earlier, is not gaining many votes for Hillary Clinton. She's been shut down in Michigan for her attempt for a recount there. It certainly has soured some Republicans in Wisconsin's views of the recount law, and they may tighten that up so people like who come in fourth place wouldn't be able to call for recounts in the future.
All right. And Mary, let's go to you for your loser of the week.
This is going to be a tentative loser because while he didn't get the Homeland Security post, it sounds like there's something coming up for Sheriff David Clark, so he could still be part of the Trump team. And obviously he has been a big booster, as we talked about, of Trump. So I think that if he gets absolutely nothing, he would be definite loser. This is more loser this week.
So we're putting a big old asterisk
Correct. There
right next to that one. We'll have to come back and see
we'll revisit
if we can move him into the winner column at some point in the coming weeks.
To be determined.
All right. And now let's go to our viewer questions. We've got several good ones today. And Patrick, I'm going to give this first one to you. It's from a viewer named Joey who says, who are the top three potential candidates to take on Tammy Baldwin in 2018?
Well, one name that's been out there for a while is Sean Duffy, the congressman from the northern part of the state. We'll see what he does. One name that I've heard only in the last day or so is Leah Vukmir, state senator from I think she lives in Brookfield now, but at any rate, southeastern Wisconsin, considering this. And then another name out there is Eric Hovde, a businessman from Madison who ran in 2012 in that four-way primary. I think he came in second there. He was able to self-finance in that campaign. If he got in this time, presumably he could do the same again.
All right. So in this case, you're taking on, it's just like Russ Feingold did, a sitting senator, but it would be more of a Republican year when it's tied in with the gubernatorial election. But do the wins from this past go-around, do they make more people interested? Can we see, you know, multiple people running for that, or will it sort of thin itself out?
Well, we'll have to see yet. I mean, I think there was going to be a lot of Republicans who were very eager to take on Tammy Baldwin because she won in a presidential year. Presidential years tend not to be as good for Republicans in this state, so they would have viewed her as someone vulnerable anyway. Ron Johnson, having just won in a presidential year, will probably boost their hopes even more. So, yeah, I think there'll be a lot of chatter. It does get complicated with a primary, you know, when a candidate knows that somebody else is going to be getting in, whether they have the wherewithal to run a primary and then a general election campaign.
All right. And, Mary, this question is from Franklin. I don't know if it's the person or the community, but
okay. Let's
assume it's a person named Franklin.
Sure.
He says, what is your opinion of Mr. Trump calling on so many military people in his cabinet? And the commenter goes on to say, people who protected our country, putting their lives on the line, great respect for democracy and so forth. But it has been striking the number of cabinet posts that are going to generals and former generals.
Right. Generals and billionaires, yeah. So, you know, I think in some way they have experience, they have the military knowledge. That's a benefit. At the same time, policing yourself is difficult. And will they be, you know, would it be better to have some kind of civilian oversight too, which is kind of what the point of some of those jobs are.
Right. I mean, one of the discussion points was for Department of Defense in particular, that typically that's a civilian position to have a general there was striking. So,
right.
Patrick, here's one from Jimmy H. who says, there are many complaints about Donald Trump and the quote-unquote bailout of Carrier Air Conditioning. This is the story in Indiana. It says, does that mean President Obama should not have bailed out the car industry? What about here in Wisconsin? Should we not give financial incentives for Illinois firms to move to Wisconsin? And this goes back to the winners and losers discussion that a lot of Republicans don't like, right? I mean, as a principle.
I mean, this has been an age-old debate, and I think a big segment of Republicans are concerned about crony capitalism. I think Sarah Palin criticized this deal, you know. But I think people need to make up their own minds, and if they don't like what happened in the car industry case, they probably wouldn't like what happened in the carrier case, regardless that one was done by a Democrat and one by a Republican. I think it's important to note the carrier jobs important to Indiana, a much smaller sort of package than what came for the car industry. You know, that was during the big recession, and was a lot more money involved there. But, you know, we've seen these debates in Wisconsin over WEDIC, the Economic Development Corporation that Governor Walker created and had some hiccups in its early days. But it all comes back to that core issue of what do you do to preserve jobs or create jobs in your state, and what's the best value for taxpayers? Because you don't want to lose jobs. You also don't want taxpayers paying so much to keep these jobs that there's really no benefit at the end of the day to the state's balance sheet.
All right, and last question is going to go to Mary from Bayview. Bob says, if the Republicans are going to take their time in phasing out Obamacare, as Paul Ryan said, doesn't that just create more confusion?
I think the idea is to not rip it right out from under people and give them time to learn about what the alternatives are going to be and have a better understanding of what's going to replace it. I don't think we have a clear understanding of what's going to replace it, so I think the idea would be to, you know, it might sow confusion for longer, but the idea that I would give people a little bit time to figure out what's happening.
I mean, no matter what, there's going to be confusion and changes and things. Well, the question seems to be whether it happens sort of instantaneously with a new plan in place or gets spread out over time like Obamacare was, as being phased in.
And I think the danger of it happening instantaneously are, you know, this is people depending on this for their insurance, their health insurance, and so do you want a bunch of people having sudden changes where maybe they're not insured or their plan changes? And I think arguably that could be a pretty dangerous situation.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's our last question we're going to get to today. We thank those of you who have been joining us in these past weeks and who joined us today. And please come back next week at the same time for another edition of JS on Politics.